Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 14th, 2018, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. And today we are going to have a really fun chat with science communicator extraordinaire, Samantha Yamin. You know her as Science Sam, or you're going to get to know her as Science Sam if you don't already. But before we dive into that, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, I say it every week. Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. That is a very important model for me. And the way I support the show and everything that we do on it, when I say we, it's because I have gotten to the point where instead of doing everything myself, I've also been able to hire an assistant to help out a bit, you know, here and there, and also an editor, which is huge. So I want to thank Noelle Dilworth, and I also want to thank the folks at Pro Podcast Solutions. You guys are amazing. But of course, this stuff don't come for free. So you guys support the show and it's huge. Those of you who can afford to, you make it so that everybody else can listen, you know, without having to sign up or subscribe or swipe a credit card. If you do want to support the show, there's a lot of ways you can do it. You can visit my website, carasantamaria.com, and there you'll see links to things. One of the links is to Patreon, patreon.com/talknerdy. That's the easiest way to support the show on an episodic basis. My big patrons this week, you're so awesome, and you also include Rob Schreck, Phil T-Bear, the zombie drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, the honorable husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. There are a bunch of other ways that you can support the show. You can shop in the Talk Nerdy store. The older merchandise that I've been selling for quite some time there, I'm going to sell out of most of that soon, and I am in the process of transferring over to a new storefront with lots more choices. So take a look. Maybe I'll throw everything up on sale that we've got right now in advance of giving you guys a bunch more options. But you know what? Let's stop talking business and let's start talking nerdy. This week, I am so thrilled that I finally got to sit down. I wish it had been in person. Unfortunately, it had to be remotely because she is up there in Canada. But I finally got to chat with Samantha Yamin. Now, you might know her as Science Sam on Instagram, on Twitter, across social media. She's working on her PhD at the University of Toronto, focusing on brain development and stem cell biology. But she's also a massive advocate for science communication in the public, for helping kind of bridge that gap between what scientists do in the lab and, you know, what people understand scientists to do in the lab. And she does so through social media, which is just a brilliant platform. So we're going to talk all about that right now. So without any further ado, here she is, Samantha Yamin, a.k.a. Science Sam. Well, Sam, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so happy we get to chat.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I'm kind of bummed that we don't get to do it in person, but of course you live far away.
I know.
You live in the cold place.
I know, Toronto, the cold place. That's a good nickname for it.
Is it nice right now?
Yes, I was on a patio yesterday, okay? Like, it happens. There's sun sometimes.
I will not tell you about my patio experiences in Los Angeles, only to invite you to please come hang out with the Nerd Brigade and with our big dorky crew out here, because we would love to have you.
Literally my dream.
All right. So I'm really thrilled to have you on the show because I do think it's been a while lately since I've had like a tried and true SciComer who's in the trenches on the show. Lately I have a lot of authors and I feel really kind of lucky that the podcast has sort of grown and evolved into a place now because I have been on for about 4 years. And now, yes. You know, I have a lot of great connections with publishing houses and they recommend great science writers to me all the time. So I have a plethora of different people who I get to choose from and invite to come join me. And so, you know, when you look at my episode list, it's mostly science writers recently, until or unless there's someone super interesting that I seek out to have on the show. And you definitely fall into that category. Oh,
thank you. You've been killing it, by the way. What you're saying.
No, you're so sweet. It's going to be so much love on this episode. Even Killer's joining in by the front door.
Hi, Killer.
Hi. Yeah, so I want to make sure that everybody who's listening, who maybe isn't as kind of inside baseball as we are, you know, like in the Beltway with SciComm, kind of knows what it is that you do and why I'm so thrilled to have you on the show. So you are technically a PhD candidate, right?
Yes. And the candidate means that I'm almost done.
Yay. Okay. So in kind of academic parlance, there, you know, different schools do it differently, different departments, all that good mm-hmm. stuff. But usually it means that you have finished most, if not all, of your coursework. You have taken some sort of qualifying examination. You have gotten the proposal for your dissertation or your thesis approved. And now you're basically finishing up whatever last research you have to do and writing ferociously and getting out the door.
Yeah. So we've done a bunch of, I've published some papers and I'm working on finishing data collection for the last few. And soon I'll be starting to write my thesis and defending and then done.
Yay. Okay. So what school are you at right now?
I'm at the University of Toronto in Ontario, Canada.
And which department?
I'm in the Department of Molecular Genetics, which has a bunch of random different topics in molecular biology in it, including what I do.
Cool. So molecular genetics at your university has its own department and it's sort of underneath the biology umbrella.
Yeah, we're in the Faculty of Medicine. And then within molecular genetics, you have people like me studying development and I do stem cell biology. You have people actually doing genetics research with human samples, growing organoids in a dish. Like, we're all over the place.
I love that. So you actually have a medical school as part of your university?
Yeah, we do. We do. And then,
that's cool.
Yeah.
And that changes things, I think, for different schools. You know, some academic institutions are connected and some aren't. And so mm-hmm. I think it's always really confusing to people when they think about, like, what's biology? What's chemistry? What's physics? And it's like, well, it kind of depends on where you go to school.
Yeah, totally. And we don't like do anything really with the med students as part of our PhD, but like it's nice that just down the hall you can have access to clinical faculty if you need to. I haven't needed to in my work, but I just think it's nice that we have such a diversity of people all around studying different things. It really helps.
And like you said, there are some people in your department that are probably using like pathology samples or, you know, somehow, or stem cells or things like that, that you probably wouldn't be able to get. I mean, you might be able to order them, but it would be much easier when you have like human subjects. Yeah. I hate to say it that way, but that is kind of the way you say it.
Access to samples.
There you go. Access to tissue. Yes, exactly. Yes. So, okay, so molecular genetics is super, super broad. Mm-hmm. Let's kind of focus in on exactly what it is that you're doing. Did you mention stem cells or was that something else? You did. Okay.
I did mention it.
Stem cells, for people who don't know, are special cells that, I mean, it's a kind of a broad bucket also because there's different mm-hmm. kinds of stem cells, but they ultimately can differentiate into different types of tissue, right?
Exactly. Nailed
and
it.
So which are you using, like progenitor cells? What kind of stem cells are you using?
Yeah, I'm studying neural stem cells, which are the stem cells of the brain. So they're specific to making all the different types of cells you find in the mature brain. And I'm studying them to figure out how our brain develops, how we get like billions and billions of cells in our brain. And a lot of that work happens because of stem cells before we're even born.
Very cool. Is there a neuroscience department at your school?
There's not, which is really interesting. I think it's because neuroscience is so interdisciplinary. You'll just mm-hmm. find the neuroscientists in Toronto embedded within a bunch of different departments, including mine.
I love that. It's really it really is university specific. I did my master's in biology and we didn't have a neuroscience department, but all of the neuro labs were in the same biology building. Whereas Crystal Dilworth, who I've had on the podcast previously, she studied neuroscience like through and through. But because she was at Caltech, she ended up doing a degree in molecular chemistry because their neuro department is mostly computational.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it is interesting how, because neuro, like you said, it can be biology. I mean, it's all biology, but it can be the chemistry of neuroscience. It can be the physics, like the electrophysiology of neuroscience. It can be the genetics of neuroscience. So you're specifically looking at developmental neuroscience.
Yeah. And I'm very, like, I'm kind of always conflicted. Like, am I a neuroscientist? Am I a cell biologist? Am I a stem cell biologist specifically? And it's basically just because biology is very interdisciplinary.
I love it, though. Oh, and there's so many different things that you have to learn to be successful in your field. Like, you have to learn lab techniques from all these different fields, but also the literature must be a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, but also thank goodness, because PhDs are long, and I think it'd be really boring if you were only ever exposed to one thing. Like, I never took any microbiology, for example, but we have these seminars where I get to go and hear people's research who are studying like yeast and bacteriophage. And I mean, I don't know what they're talking about half the time, but I think it's really cool that I can be exposed to stuff beyond my specialty, because it'd get pretty dull now and then.
I feel you. I feel you. You know, they do say, right, isn't the joke that when you first start out as a scientist, you know a little bit about a whole lot. And by the end, you know a whole lot about very little.
Basically.
Because it just gets more, I mean, it's a funnel, right? It gets more and more narrow, the
so
more
specialized.
So, you know, you are like really, really active on social media. You're Science Sam. And anybody who's listening might just now be making that connection. You may already follow Sam. Yeah, on Instagram. And you share so much about the ins and outs of your scientific process, about the methods and kind of about sometimes just the sociological implications of being a scientist.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
the daily stressors, but also sometimes the excitement when something goes your way. I would love it if maybe you would do a little translation from that video or visual medium, kind of photographic and video, that is Instagram, into now this audio medium, and share with the audience here kind of the ins and outs of what you do. Like, what are the kinds of experiments that you're doing right now, and what could they see if they were to log onto your Instagram?
Yeah. So I do a ton of what's called cell culture. So I'm constantly taking, not constantly, but really often, I'm taking neural stem cells from mouse brains and growing them up in a dish so that I can better observe them, because it's kind of hard to see them when they're in an intact brain. So I do a ton of cell culture. You'll see me always showing you views of cells through the microscope. So as I'm doing my experiments, when there's a little break, I pop out my phone and I'll be like, here you go. This is what I'm looking at through the microscope. And then what I get to do, which is the visual part that people love, is I can fix those cells, hold them kind of in time, and make them fluorescent depending on their content, their protein content. And that's where I get these really beautiful images of like star-shaped astrocytes in the brain, beautiful like webby-looking neurons. People tend to love those pictures. And that's because I'm trying to identify cells and to see what my stem cells are making. And that ends up being like a really difficult philosophical thing of like, how do we really identify a cell? Like, what is the minimum requirement for calling it this or that?
Yeah, it's hard, right? With fluorescence. Like, you end up with these really pretty pictures, but like you said, the point of it is that like some of them are labeled green, some of them are labeled red. And that's because you're labeling something in the cell that you're hoping tells you it's this type of cell, not that type of cell.
Yeah. And then the cool thing is that people who've never looked at these types of images before will see them and be like, oh, why is that one a different shape than the other green one? And I'm like, I don't know. And this is exactly the technical challenge. Like, everyone can understand the technical challenges. I went on a tangent, but
no, it's so true. So I only did fluorescent microscopy. Yeah, no, for sure. I did fluorescent microscopy for a year when I started my PhD 10 years ago and dropped out. And it was the first time I'd done it. I'd been working on mouse cells. I wasn't working on stem cells. I was working on, I guess, I don't know if you want to call them mature, but full kind of neurons from fetal mouse tissue that I would then sort of dissociate, and then they would regrow into primary networks in vitro. And so I cultured a lot of those, and it was really interesting, and I got, you know, pretty adept at it. And then, of course, I completely switched gears when I left my master's and started a PhD, which I never finished, as I mentioned. Let me be clear, never finished. And that's when I moved on to birds. And this is a tangent too, because birds have nucleated red blood cells. So when you look at their brains, there are all sorts of cells in there that shouldn't be there.
Oh God, that's a mess.
And it is so annoying, because a lot of times we would be labeling these fluorescently we would be labeling aspects of the nucleic acids. And most of us, most mammals, all mammals really, their red blood cells, if you remember what a red blood cell looks like, guys who are listening, like the little donut cells, they don't have nuclei.
Yeah.
And so it's, they don't muck up your slides. But like you're saying, it's really hard to tell the difference sometimes between this type of support cell and that type of support cell when there are other types of body cells that are hanging out in your cultures that usually you don't even label. That can be a bitch.
Yeah. And then it's also just that we're getting so much better technologically, like with our biotech really, and our actual tech that helps us analyze our data, that we're starting to see that, okay, before, if you have this protein inside you, beta-3 tubulin, for example, you're a neuron. But now we're like, the closer we look, we see that actually there's a little bit of that protein in other cells. And so the other cool part of my research is that we're incorporating some of this newer tech to look at cells instead of like by the handful individually and get this like single cell resolution to understand the cells we're working with. And then we're finding all of this heterogeneity. And some of it you would have already gotten a hint of when you look at the pictures I post, and absolutely all types of my audience, they start to pick up on that. And now we're actually, you know, quantifying it and really delving deep genetically into what the differences are. And it's pretty cool. So I'm a lot at the computer lately, which is kind of boring for my followers, but interesting in some ways too.
Yeah, because it takes separate stages, right? There's the wet lab part, which I think a lot of people think of scientists as like always sitting at the bench and always doing wet lab stuff. But a lot of times you're just doing that to actually get the data. Once you have the data, there's a whole second half of analyzing it.
Yeah, and I try to show that too. So like I do a lot of kind of computer shots, a lot of shots of me just like in bed in a weird position as I'm trying to stay comfortable while I've been analyzing for hours. And I show that because I'm like, this is science. It's like taking a step back as well and thinking about the data and being critical. Like that's the important part, is where we take things that we observe and then we try to figure out what they mean. And we reiterate as we find, you know, reasons to.
Oh, the really fun part is going to be once you've collected all the data you need and you get to the point where they're just staring at a SAS screen or a MATLAB screen, just like, yay, statistics.
Of course. And yeah, and of course, I think this is not unique to my institution, but like biologists in general, we have like no stats training. And so it's the bane of my existence right now is like, how do I deal with this data?
Like, you know what? It's so true. I did an undergrad in psych, and I've come full circle now, and I'm actually restarted my PhD just this year. I'm a first year in clinical psychology.
Cool. Yeah, I didn't know that. What?
I'm not that public. I mean, I talk about it on the podcast, but I don't like post too many. So if you're more into the visual medium, like Instagram or something, you probably only know that I have a very cute dog. But yeah, so I'm, you know, kind of coming up towards the end of my first year back in school. And of course, because my master's is in neuroscience and none of it counts towards my PhD. So it's like starting over as a 34-year-old. It's very strange learning how to write papers again and do all that. But anyway, long story short, when I did my master's, it was in the biology department. I had no bio training because I was a psych undergrad and philosophy undergrad. And when it came time to take the minimally required stats classes, not only did I completely test out of almost all of them, like I didn't even have to take univariate because I had so much stats under my belt, but the multivariate class was really elementary. And I remember thinking, man, as a psychology student, by the time I got my bachelor's degree, I had more stats training than I learned in my master's biology degree. And it was the same requirements as the PhD students in the biology department. Why is that? Why don't we train our biologists to do statistics?
I honestly don't. I mean, I guess the assumption is that you'll learn it when you need it, and everyone will need like different types of stats depending on the nature of their work. It's like, I guess that's what it is. And that a lot of biology undergrads don't necessarily go on to do research. So I can see it from that angle. But like as an undergrad, I wanted more stats, but it didn't fit into my course calendar. And so I couldn't. And then I took some and I was like, oh, this is the worst. So never mind.
Then so
I got to my PhD and I'm like, damn it, how do I analyze this? And I'm of course, like, you don't know anything by the time you get to your research position. So you're learning everything de novo anyways. So I read up what I could, but I really often feel like I should probably know more. Like, I should be a little more confident in knowing what's the right and like tool to use right now.
You know what I think this is? I think this is a racket from the statisticians, because they know that when you're working on your PhD and then later, if you were going to be a lab bench scientist, that you're just going to have to hire statisticians.
Yeah, totally. It's like, they make it like overly complicated in the beginning so that they're like, you need us, which is brilliant. And like, I applaud them for the business model. Well done. You are right. We need you.
So it's interesting because math is really fundamental to science, and everybody takes math courses. And most universities, if you have a science major, require some level of math within the math department, and then maybe some level of science classes that have a math angle, like let's say physics that's calculus based. So did your undergraduate degree, we'll start there, did you mostly take physics type math classes?
I took first year calculus, which I loved. Like, I really enjoyed calculus, but I don't want to knock the math people. It was pretty useless. Like, I don't use it at all.
Interesting. And do you think you would have benefited from taking stats instead as a biologist?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I loved trig. I thought it was so fun. But and I know that a lot of the things I use in the lab and in my everyday life, you know, depend on that math and calculus and trig and all that. But in my actual research, I do need some math that I don't know, which is like that as it's applied to statistics. So it probably would have made sense, instead of taking first year physics as well, to like have a little more stats and also a little more coding, because now I'm dealing with big data sets and I'm having to work with bioinformaticians, which is good, but it would also be great if I had been more coached into to taking some amount of coding just to like deal with big data.
Yeah, we're woefully underprepared in that realm. And I mean, people like myself who, like I said, I'm approaching 35 this year. I had no computer science training in school. I might have taken like a touch typing class when I was in third grade or something. But I think that the newer, like the more deep into the millennial generation, and even now, what's the generation after millennials?
Oh God, I don't know.
There's a name for it. I can't remember what it is, but the hope is that they're actually learning more computer coding, kind of almost the way you would learn as a language. So hopefully we'll start to see that gets integrated more into the undergrad or even the graduate curriculum, but also that kids are coming into college having a basic understanding, because they're digital natives. They're growing up on this stuff.
Yeah, I think it's also cool just to know how the technology you use every day works, and like even just a basic understanding of Boolean logic and if statements, I think it's applicable to a lot of parts of your life. Like, that's the cool thing about science. I think the logic and the premises, the philosophy that underlies it, are applicable to everything in a really cool way.
And
I think we emphasize that, like, people don't need to be coding their own websites necessarily, although that's pretty useful. But like, just if you get the basic logic and then maybe how to apply that to different things in different ways, I think that's super helpful and productive for society.
Yeah, and my other podcast, In the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, like a common refrain week after week is that we need to kind of flex our philosophy muscle more. And that just fundamental to critical thinking and to, you know, being a skeptic is exercising our understanding of basic logic and basic problem solving. And it's just something at least I can say that American society, and I know that in many respects, Canadian society, although more progressive in many ways, there is kind of an Americanization of Canada that has happened over the past several decades, where we just are like woefully kind of underprepared to use our critical thinking skills.
And I think it comes right down to the fact that my biology undergrad was a lot of memorizing. Like, I hated biology in high school because it was only memorizing, and I loved chem and physics because it was problem solving and like hands-on. And it's just like all of those facts. I try not to tell too many facts on my Instagram even, because I don't think they're useful. People like them, so they're a good hook. But it's not useful for you to know that there are 170 billion cells in your brain. Like, one.
And also you can just Google it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, totally. I remember when we had to memorize the periodic table, I was like, but why?
Like, you're like, I can just look at it. Like, I have it right here and I'm looking at it.
I think it's important for me to understand how it's organized and why it's organized and why things change as we go like across groups and whatever. Like, what? I don't remember. Exactly. I don't remember. Like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but like how to use it is way more important than being able to memorize it.
And how we get to those facts, how we get to those discoveries that's important, because now when someone tells you you'll get cancer if you do this, you know, to be able to say, huh, I wonder how someone could have done the experiment that makes that true. And then you'll realize like, that would have not been possible to test. I think that that person's lying, and maybe I can continue doing this, or maybe I should stop it immediately. That's useful, right?
It's so useful. And it also helps us not reinvent the wheel over and over, which I think we have kind of had a problem with, both in the sciences, but even broader than that. Yeah. Which is kind of like, I mean, it's really important, obviously, to replicate different experiments to just make sure that the way they were done the first time holds true. But at a certain point, like banging your head against the wall, trying the same thing over and over, because A, you don't have open access to data, and B, you are thinking, like, not you personally, but that's the royal you. You are thinking a little bit narcissistically that you're the first person who ever had this idea. That just comes from not knowing why we know the things we know.
Yeah. And honestly, that's what I love Twitter for, is that you put out ideas and then like six people comment with like, here are all the different times people have done that already. Like, it always feels a little crappy, but I'm like, you know, this is useful. Like, again, being connected, the connectedness is useful. And like discussions are useful, like discussion-based learning is useful, because everyone kind of has different exposure to things. And instead of being redundant all the time and like wasting resources and time, I think it's a great idea.
Absolutely. And I want to actually pivot to that, to this area of social media in just a second. But first, I have to revisit statistics for a second.
Yeah, yeah,
mostly because I'm in it again now that I'm back in school. I already took my univariate. Now I'm retaking And when I say retake, it's because I took it in other degrees. But this next semester, I'm about to take multivariate again. And it's not easy. Don't get me wrong. It's not easy. But one thing that I really appreciate about all of my statistics training is that it really does. The more you learn about it and the more that you really understand the ins and outs of not just the math, but the organization, it starts to help you literally see the world differently. And you have this way that you organize data, that you start to see data graphically and pictorially, so that now when people talk about the mean being this, the median being that, the standard deviation being this, and the R value being here, or Cronbach's alpha being there, you can physically see what they're saying in these beautiful kind of distributions in your mind. And now the data takes on a greater life that it just didn't take on before.
Yeah, that's honestly amazing, because we're in such a data rich world. And I think we need to start organizing the information out there. We need to start like actually understanding it. So it's useful. And I love that you can get that appreciation from what I found to be boring stats classes.
Talk to me about calculus and we'll have a different conversation. But you know, to each their own, we all find certain things interesting. So, okay, I do want to switch gears, and I want to talk about kind of the power of social media, because I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring it up. I don't know how many of my listeners, again, are inside the Beltway enough to be reading journal articles and to have followed kind of some interesting developments that happened recently in an article that you had the opportunity, under not so fun circumstances, to publish. But let's kind of talk about this scenario, this sort of unfolding that took place within just the past few months, right?
Yeah, I think a month and a half. Even
only a month and a half. Okay.
Yeah, it's very real and fresh.
So it started when an opinion piece, a blog post, was actually published. Was it Science or Nature?
It was in the Working Life section of Science.
Okay. So Science, for people who don't know, is like the top tier journal in the sciences. Like Science and Nature are the two journals that everybody wishes to publish. These are the journals where like the cover story is like CRISPR invented. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's the big stuff.
Like when you are watching the news or reading the news and you hear a new study found, if it's a good one, it was probably in, you know, if it's big, it was probably in one of those.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like my professor, who I did my master's degree under at the University of North Texas, was really brilliant man. And he did a lot of really great stuff in the world. And he's been published hundreds and hundreds of times. I don't think he was ever published in Science. You know what I mean? Like it's a goal. It's a dream for a lot of people.
It's like what you work so hard for, what I've been like pulling 16-hour days for, you know?
Absolutely. And so the thing is, Science is this amazing journal, but it also has, as of late, I think, done a pretty good job of having a strong web presence and offering different kind of subcategories and different kind of areas for maybe deeper dives into, like you said, it's got different sections now.
Yeah.
And so a piece was posted in the what section?
Working life. Which is a section I enjoy. Like, I like these subsections.
So yeah. Working life is like what it's like a day in the life of a scientist?
Yeah, just things that are relevant to those who do science.
That's cool.
Totally.
Like support. Like, oh, okay, yeah, it's exactly. Not just me.
Yeah, that's like where people go to like vent about like, this is an issue, or like, these are things we need to think about more about the day-to-day of academia. And those are topics that I love talking about. So I, in general, like the section.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. Yeah.
And so, of course, this is not a peer-reviewed section, and this is a section where you could probably liken it more unto blog pieces or unto the opinion section of the New York Times.
Absolutely. They don't allow references, which is an important point in that section.
Oh, wow. How funny. I wonder who came up with that rule. And like,
maybe they break it, but in general, you don't have references.
I think that that's cool though. Cause it's like, stop with the academic speak. Let's talk to each other like people.
Yeah. Real talk. Yeah. Totally.
Real talk. I love it. So a piece comes out about a month and a half ago in this section of science. And it's all about, you know, people who communicate science. And it's all about, you know, this one person's opinion of that matter. And then it's sort of exposed that this one person happens to be somebody who is at your university, and that one person happened to, did they call you out by name, or did they just talk so much about you that everybody could tell it was you?
No, it said Science Sam, which is your moniker. Essentially my name. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean,
people know me as Science Sam than Samantha Mee. So yeah.
Okay, so a piece comes out, and that piece, I think, has a lot of, you know, important points in it and makes some statements that are interesting, and I think that we all agree with, but also make some points about basically the idea of science communication and why science communication maybe as an outlet is not the most appropriate, or maybe using Instagram is not the most appropriate way to communicate one science. And I think some of it, it's a thin argument that's made, and a lot of people kind of agree with that. But the most kind of discomforting aspect of this is that it felt a little bit personal. It felt a little bit like you were singled out on your campus, and this was somebody who shares a campus with you. So it was a little like, what is this? Why would somebody be publishing something like this in a really respectable journal?
I think the only line that is of merit is the part that women and underrepresented minorities tend to take on the burden of outreach. I think that's like pretty much the only valid point. And the most disturbing point to me is the reduction and objectification of women to their appearance, right? You know, the cute selfies, the pretty smiles, cute outfits or whatever. I forget what the words were. I haven't read it in a few weeks. But that's the most disturbing part. Yeah, the personal nature, like, whatever, I can deal with that. I put myself out there. But the fact that it's so objectifying of women to me was the most disturbing.
Yeah. Okay. So I finally pulled it up, and I'm looking at it again because I read this quite a while ago.
Yeah.
And you're right. Like, it actually just, it's your name is the first word in the article. So it's like,
it is. Yeah. It was a personal,
this is about Science Sam. She's a star. Her Instagram page is awesome. That said, I'm not happy with all these women on Instagram posting selfies and equating their work with this, like, with this aspect of SciComm. And it's like, I don't really understand. Okay, so that, yeah, they celebrate a narrow representation of femininity. Mm-hmm. I'm bitter about this because I don't like so many female scientists who have to turn their social media pages into this in order to try to correct the system's failure. So I think I tend to operate using the principle of charity. And really what that means is that I assume, or at least I look at things as if somebody is not vindictive, as if somebody is not actually kind of utilizing some sort of negative attempt at something. And then I work backward from there. So let's give the person the benefit of the doubt and say that they're trying to make a point, and that point is actually a valid point, but they're just misguided in how they're doing it.
Totally. And I mean, that's the psychological approach. So I love it. Yes.
Yeah. And I don't think everybody did. I'm sure that this, the person who wrote this article got a lot of backlash. I'm sure that the person who wrote this article got a lot of support. But ultimately, what I didn't like about this article is that A, it singled you out, like using your Instagram as some sort of, I never pronounce this word right, but synecdoche, for all PsyCop. Yeah. So it's like using a part as a whole or a whole as a part. Like, I feel like it's like, okay, look at Science Sam. She is PsyCom on the internet. And it's like, first of all, thanks. That's awesome.
I was like, all right, cool.
But also like, hi, there's a lot of other ways that people do Instagram or that people do PsyCom. And then secondly, okay, what is the point of basically denigrating? So there's this paragraph that says a lot of good comes from the work of female scientists on Instagram. Okay, good. But it disturbs me that these efforts are celebrated as ways to correct for the long-held and deeply structured forms of discrimination and exclusion that female scientists face. I wonder whether our efforts should instead be directed towards advocating for policy changes at institutional and governmental levels. And it, like, that is a logical fallacy. It's a false equivalency.
The false dichotomy.
Yeah, like because, you can't. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. Dichotomy. That's the right word. And it's you can't. Yeah. It's not either or. It's both.
Yeah. And in fact, I mean, the real irony is that I started my Instagram account at a week long intensive science policy conference or workshop. I started it and I was in those rooms meeting with the top science policy people in the country. I was in Ottawa, our nation's capital, learning from them. And I was like, wow. They need help because they want to make changes and the public doesn't agree. And so we need to foster more science culture. Cool. I'm going to go on social media. Like, that's literally how I started my account. I am so science policy driven and I am at the table in science policy discussions because I've made a platform for myself online through social media. So that was the real irony that nobody knows.
Oh, and that must have been kind of the hot poker of this whole thing. Because like you said,
it killed me.
You know, with the part where it's like kind of, it really does feel like an ad hominem, like a personal attack. Like, who knows if it was motivated by jealousy? Who knows if it was motivated by, you know, whatever. Like, there are a million ways that we can carve this up psychologically. But the truth of the matter is, A, it's just not, I think, good form. It's not appropriate and it's not professional. It's not scientifically professional to throw somebody under the bus in such a public forum when you've never taken the time to talk to them ahead of time.
I mean, mostly that it's inaccurate. That's the
there you go.
I actually am like very open to critique. I think that there are a lot of things that we get right and a lot of things we get wrong on Instagram and like in life in general. And I have friends that always hold me accountable, call me out. And that's a really important part of advocacy is holding people accountable and talking to them. But there's a medium for that. This was really uninformed. And if we had just had a conversation first, I think the article would have been written really differently.
Well, yeah, and that's what, and that's the difference. Absolutely. That's really in many ways the difference between, so there's peer-reviewed journal articles, which is where a scientist will take all of their work that they've been working at really hard and they follow a very important structure. And that structure has very specific requirements. And then they'll publish and a team of reviewers will ensure that it's up to standards. There is journalism that has its own kind of code of ethics where you generally have to look at multiple sides of an argument before you sit down to write about it so that you have the most informed position you can. And then there's opinion pieces, which unfortunately don't have any parameters around them. And this feels like a strong opinion piece that wasn't really researched.
And can I mean, I actually think she did do a lot of research. I just think that a lot of people don't understand social media and there's a lot of data behind that guides what I and others do. And then there's a lot that happens in DMs that takes time. And that was part of the argument, but there's just a lot of data missing in the public domain that again, through discussions could have been really clear and provided, but, yeah. And then I just want to say like opinions, I think are really important and people are very much entitled to their opinion. Yes. But I don't think all opinions are entitled to amplification on broad platforms. And that's something we're struggling with in the media more broadly.
I agree. I think that this is kind of in some ways a microcosm of the culture right now, which is that the people with maybe whether it's the loudest voice or the people who know the right people who can get their opinions out there in a certain way or a people who can dog whistle to specific. And of course, I'm not saying that this person is dog whistling to anybody. I'm more talking about kind of a political movement in America as it is. Yeah. But yeah, it's, in a way, it is a microcosm of that. And I think that's a super important point to make. So, of course, I don't want to spend too much more time on this article because I want to talk about your responses and kind of in some ways how this dark cloud had a really beautiful silver lining. But basically, I think the biggest bummer, obviously, it's a multifaceted bummer for you personally, because this felt very ad hominem towards you. But for, I think, SciComm in general, it really did feel like, dude, why are you trying to, like, put a turd in the SciComm pool? Like, we're all in it. You know what I mean? Like, we're all kind of in this for the same reasons. And we're all kind of in this to try and get what we do out there in the public to improve funding, to improve understanding, to improve science literacy. And basically, you're quibbling about, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, and yeah, it's like, I don't even post that many selfies. Like, I just have endless frustration. I don't even, and like, when I do, I post a selfie because I know they get more engagement and I'm trying to talk about something important, like the Science March, or like, you know, I'm like using it for the, like, something that's so important, and let's talk about that.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I realized that about a year ago. I'm not a big Instagrammer. Like, compare my Twitter and my Facebook following to my Instagram, and it's a fraction. It's maybe like a fourth. And on, it's mostly because I'm not a photographer. I don't like taking pictures, so I just don't have that many in my phone, and they're all of my dog. And when I'm on set and I'm doing really cool, awesome stuff, I'm usually with professional videographers and photographers, and I'm like, they're gonna get a better shot, so why would I waste time? And then I'm like, because now I can't share it with anybody. derp. But that said, when I did one of those best nines once, and if you're a woman who has an Instagram account, you've probably made this discovery as well. When you look up your best nine, it's all selfies,
and it's not even just for women. You know, the top rating type of post is a guy with a baby.
Really? Oh, well, there you go. So
people do better than one, and a guy with a baby does better than any two-person photo. I mean, like, in general. That's what the data say. I saw that at a conference.
Hilarious. So, it's like, at a certain point, you know what works, and you use it within reason and within your ethical boundaries, right? It's the same way that advertisers have been doing it for ages. It's the same way that journalists have been doing it for ages. You know, a journalist might write a very clean, really beautiful article, but the title might have to be a little clickbaity just so people will read it. I mean, it's the nature of the game.
Yeah. And like, I'm also super careful about the type of selfies I take. I'm like really self-conscious about sharing pictures of my body. That's a whole other discussion. So they're more my face, and I keep them unedited besides like changing color.
Yeah. Like, slap an Instagram filter on it. That's fine.
Yeah. Like, I take out the yellow tone of the lab because it's weird. Not realistic.
Lab probably always looks really yellow, huh?
Yeah. So I make it like a little Instagrammy, but I don't, you know, touch up photos, and it's so political. There's so much to unpack.
And the truth is, even if you did, that's fine. I mean, like, I don't either, but I have friends who are like all about Facetune, and I'm like, ooh, you look hot. And they're like, Facetune.
I mean, my point was mostly that, like, I actually overthink the responsibility of my platform and overthink the way that I use tools. And I like hold them to like a standard that I keep kind of personal because I don't think people want to hear about it. But I like care so much about media literacy. So I just thought it was like really ironic I was getting thrown under the bus like that.
it's so important that you say that, because I think so many people, the same way we interact with, and this goes back to things we were talking about earlier, the same way we interact with our iPhones, where we're like, I don't know how it works, but if it's a little slow, I'm annoyed. It's like, we're the same way with social media. We follow these different accounts that put out beautiful pictures or that put out all these really kind of informative posts. And then we don't think about the fact that those people are working really hard at it, and they're actually thinking very deeply before they hit.
And I go to conferences about it. I do meetups. I talk with other influencers in other industries. Like, we actually do a lot of knowledge mobilization within our community that if you're not in the community, you wouldn't know. Because I think it's like not relevant, but if you wanted to know, we'd tell you, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just people, critique should be coming from a knowledge-based perspective.
And I do think that there's always an appropriate forum. You know, I've been getting more
important.
Absolutely. Now that I've been getting more involved in psychology, of course, you join APA, which is the American Psychological Association here in the United States. And you also, in order to get your psychology license, you have to really deeply understand the ethics code. And the number one thing in the APA ethics code is that when there is some sort of complaint in psychology, like say a person did something that was unethical, like God forbid, you know, had sex with a patient. That's like kind of the worst thing you can do, but mm-hmm. maybe even something else where they, you know, I don't know, whatever they did, that's a violation of the ethics code. It still says even within the ethics code that you are supposed to confront them and try to have an informal resolution first before it gets raised to any sort of ethics committee.
And it's so important. Like, there are a lot of problems in science and academia that, like, I'm really passionate about, but I don't put them on blast publicly because that does more harm than good.
Absolutely. You know? It's like you should always do that first. That's just common knowledge. And then maybe there's an ombudsman or there's some other formal way to do it. But usually those are anonymous, just saying. Okay. So anyway, this comes out. It mentions you by name. People are like, WTF. And you're like, holy crap, what is this about? And so then, of course, there's all this fallout and, you know, people are rallying behind certain people and it becomes probably bigger than, you know, anybody expected it to be. But then, hopefully, I'm assuming this is what happened. I want you to tell me if I'm right. Mm-hmm. Science got enough backlash in the comment section or enough letters to the editor that they were like, ooh, we need to do something about this. So they said, hey, you guys want to write something in response?
Yeah, so the chief editor of Science, not even the editor of Working Life, chief editor. Okay, like, what? Never thought I would get an email from him. And he seems like a good guy, actually, I'll say that. He sent me an email the next day, right away. I don't know how soon, it was kind of an overwhelming time. So he sends me an email pretty much right away, being like, we are sorry, we didn't mean this to be taken this way, and we didn't intend for it to be a personal attack, and we invite you to submit a response.
Okay. And so do you appreciate that? I mean, because at a certain point, once something is posted, you know, you can quibble all you want about, did an editor actually read it? Was there some sort of preferential treatment getting this posted? How did they get this on air? But once it's on air, it is what it is. And it didn't retract it. I mean, it's an opinion piece. And they basically said, here are our responses to it. And we're giving a platform for, and it's not just a comment to this post, you got to write a whole new post, which we'll get into. But do you appreciate that it's still there, that anybody can read it, and that they can read all of the conversations around it?
Yeah, I think it's okay that it's still up. I wasn't advocating for it to get taken down, although I understand those who were, and I support that opinion too. Mm-hmm. For me, it's like, here is a blatant example of within oppressed groups, there are challenges, and there's a lot of difficulty within groups. And this is a blatant example of misogyny towards femme-presenting women. And it's up there so that we can learn from it. And I don't think we should erase that because I think it has important lessons. I do worry that those who are reading it in print, who won't be seeing the online discussions, it will serve as those who tend to read it in print, I'm assuming, are like older and so maybe might not be on Twitter. And that might serve as a confirmation bias to them. So I worry about that.
I didn't even know that this had a print portion.
Oh, yeah. So that's why. So that's what I worry about. For example, even my professor, he's not on Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. So my supervisor. So he would just see it in print. And that's why I was really grateful that they let us. I was very clear, like, I will do a response, but it must be given equal reach. Like, it must also be in print. And I want this many words because I need to tell this much of the story.
Is Science a weekly publication or a monthly publication?
I think it's bi-weekly.
Bi-weekly.
Week.
Okay, so is yours in the Working Life section of the very next issue?
No, because I didn't want to be in the Working Life section. I wanted to be given a certain amount of space, and I wanted to be able to have references. Mm-hmm. And they were kind in granting us space for references, because I think these topics require data. They shouldn't be a matter of opinion. Anecdotes are helpful. So I'm not knocking that, but I think we need data when we talk about these things, and Working Life's not the right.
Yeah.
We needed more.
Anecdotes are helpful, but they're only helpful to illustrate things that we know to be true based on the data.
Yeah. Or to fill in gaps in the data, because social sciences are sometimes limited in what they can study with humans. Right. So I think anecdotes are helpful, but I think we needed to address this with data. So I wanted to do a different section. So we were given a letter section, which is where people can give comments. It doesn't happen in every version of the journal. You can submit responses to something previously published.
Yeah. Okay. And so,
it was appropriate.
So let me see. I'm finding your article here. Is it the one called Social Media for Social Change in Science?
Yes.
There it is. Letters. And it wasn't just written by you. Oh, Paige. I know Paige.
Yeah.
It was written by you, Christine Liu, Paige Giroux, and Imogen Co. And yes. So a group of individuals got together, all quite influential science communicators, right?
Yeah, I decided to invite others to write it with me for a number of reasons, because I think they're all experts. Paige is an expert in SciComm research. Christine mm-hmm. is a fellow PhD who I know, and she started a lot of online communities. She's an amazing trailblazer in equity and inclusion communities online. And then Imogen Co is a dean of science at a university in Toronto, and she's also an amazing world-renowned trailblazer and champion for more equity and diversity in STEM.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. And so you guys got together, you looked through the scientific literature, and you crafted an article in the letter section about, yeah. and you even say at the very beginning, although we agree that there are many systemic structures yeah. perpetuating the marginalization of women in science, we view social media as a powerful tool. So let's talk about that, because
yeah.
to me, it's kind of like a no-brainer. Of course, social media is a powerful tool. And there have been multiple peer-reviewed studies supporting that, like showing
absolutely.
That people are more likely to get funded, showing that people are more likely to get their opinion, not their opinions, their findings into the public consciousness. You know, all these things contribute. So let's talk about why it is that social media has really, in many ways, been a game changer for mm-hmm. science communication.
Yeah, it's a social media. The amazing thing, and again, the irony with the comments made in the original piece, is that social media is a high throughput platform. It lets you reach and get out messages to many people in an instant, which is amazing. And we're doing, and so that science communication can exist on social media means that for, you know, some amount of effort, you can now reach nearly infinite people with a third of the world's population online.
Yeah.
The other way that it's a game changer is I was doing events in person in Toronto. That's really limited in who it can reach. I can only really like logistically and financially reach the people in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And I live in downtown Toronto. You're already selecting there with who you're talking to. On social media, I can reach people in Brazil, which is important because they're having troubles right now with their science funding and science policy. I can reach people across the world in Australia. I can reach people in India, in parts of Europe. Like we can instantly connect with people who I would never get to meet, and that's game changing. You get so many cool perspectives. You get to increase the learning, increase access. It's more equitable. I love it.
Absolutely. And there's different yeah. aspects of social media, right? And like different people have mm-hmm. different skills in those different social media platforms.
Yeah.
You consider yourself more of like an, like, I mean, you have obviously a Twitter and you have a Facebook, but like, do you put most of your effort into Instagram?
Yeah, I use Instagram to try to reach the public because I think that's where a lot of non-science people are, and that's not the right word, but a lot of people not in science themselves, I think, are on Instagram. I think it's a really cool visual platform. So you have like this power to make science cool. I try to take my photos like how the fashion bloggers take their photos, mm-hmm. Like same color schemes, because I also like those colors, and kind of make it cooler. So now people are like, oh, nice photo. Oh, wait, it's about science. That's interesting. And you can hook them in visually, which is really fun.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I have several friends who have been very, very successful with their SciComm mm-hmm. on Instagram, just because it's a platform that's so visual and really lends itself to that. So if that's kind of the area where you yeah. have the most skills, that's really appropriate. I think I'm just, you know, heavier on Twitter because I'm older. And I think I just, I connected to Twitter when Twitter was really big. And it still is, yeah. obviously. Facebook is still yeah. the biggest one, which I just hate Facebook.
Yes.
I have some... So even though I'm on it, like every day I'm threatening to shut it down. But but Twitter just makes more sense to me because I'm more of a written word kind of person than a visual yeah. person.
I love Twitter personally. I learned so I probably spend more time on Twitter, but put mm-hmm. more effort into my Instagram.
That makes sense.
The cool thing about Instagram too is that there's so many layers of depth. So like it can be people just look at your pictures, they're already taking something away. It could be people just watching your stories. Those are quick videos. Or they could actually read my whole caption, which they're long and not everyone does. And that's cool. And there's just so many layers of depth that you can offer people. Then we can yeah. have back and forth conversation. There's less of a character limit. You could DM, you could live stream. Like there's just so many layers to it that it's like, it's incredible. We're not even tapping into it. And it's suitable no matter how much someone wants to consume. There's a little snack or like full meal of science for them just waiting.
Can I just say, how much do you love that you got to write a piece, A, in science, and B, where you use the word selfie, which only entered the dictionary like a couple years ago?
It was, yeah, that, I'm not going to lie, that was like pretty gratifying.
I'm but, like, what is life right now? But you can put, look, selfies on Instagram are optional, but they receive 38% more engagement than pictures without a face.
Yeah, totally. It was really cool that I got to publish in science because I don't think I otherwise would have ever.
Oh, come on. You are so at the beginning of your career. You have no idea.
But I had also been planning to pitch the story of our community to a major journal. I'd been planning it, but I was like, I think we're still like a little bit young and we need like a little more time. But I had this like great idea and I was going to engage people in the community to help me write it. It's going to be so good. So I'm like it's a little unfortunate I didn't get to do it the way I was like planning, where we'd be highlighting and talking about it in a positive light, and instead that we had to do it defensively. But nonetheless, I'm grateful we got to do it.
Is there anything else kind of, as obviously anybody can read this, Social Media for Social Change in Science. You just Google that, it'll come right up. Is there anything else that you learned working with these three other incredible women as you were writing this and getting it ready for publication that maybe you didn't know or that maybe helped reinforce some of the ideas that you had been like, you know, trying to crystallize?
Yeah, like not to brag, but because I already talked to these people all the time, there were a lot of things I already knew that I just never got to share.
Yeah.
So a lot of those references, some of them I was reading for the first time, but most of them I had already had saved on my computer. So yeah.
That's awesome.
And it's only because I know these three other people and like a bunch of other people, including yourself, who talk about these things in like an informed way that I've already been accumulating this knowledge for a while. So I know I sound like so annoying saying that.
No, it's, but that's the thing. I think that one of the things that I haven't done the best job of, because I'm so actively in it that I need to be a little bit more meta about it, is actually reading the science of science communication. And maybe this is actually inspiring me to maybe ask Paige to come on the show, because I think talking about the science.
Amazing.
Yes. Talking about the science of SciComm is actually so important.
Yeah. And the thing is that the literature is a little bit behind because again, like science takes time. So the cool thing that I've gotten the opportunity to go to some conferences about social media, and hearing the private companies share their data has been really interesting because they're really quick with analyzing the latest trends. And so that's been really informative and really cool.
Yeah.
The important thing I learned writing this piece was about like, what is the most important message? Let's distill down. Because I wrote 30 pages. I'm not exaggerating. Like when I read the piece, I just went on a writing spree. Wow. I had so much. And I was really still like kind of emotional in how I was coping. And working with the others helped me to formalize and distill to our key message. And just being able to, in such a difficult moment, just like go back to the data, take a deep breath, and tell the important story. That was a huge learning experience for me.
Absolutely. It's such, I mean, in a way, it's like, it's a bummer that this had to be the way that this conversation was had, but I'm so glad that this conversation was had, because I think it's happening behind the scenes all the time. And again, I don't know if it being published in science opens it up necessarily to a broader public audience, but at least to other scientists who are kind of blissfully unaware of kind of this new burgeoning movement of SciComm.
Yeah, totally. I think that it's good to be able to get some recognition from my peers and to try to tell them the importance of what I'm doing. Because, yeah, like I feel silly taking a selfie at a conference and people see me like that doesn't feel, you know, I'm not that confident. So to be able to now say like, I mean, there's some validity to it.
Yeah. Well, and also like,
nice.
You might be in the minority right now, but you'll be within the majority within like 5 years. I really think so. It's
totally. Yeah.
It's just our lives are partially online now. And yes, you can live your whole life not being involved in social media. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. And I do think that sometimes we do have to take a step back and realize like, like the internet is not real life. Like it's just an aspect of real life. Like it's important to find that balance between the two. But the truth is, it's not going away. It's only going to become a bigger part of who we are.
And whether you like it or not, the younger generation is consuming it more than ever and more than any of us. And so like, if we want to give them an opportunity to have access to things that we think are important, like science, we better be putting stuff on social media, because that's where all of the influence on the younger, not all, a lot of influence mm-hmm. on the younger generation is happening through social media, and scientists aren't having a say. They're not contributing to it.
Instead, they feel they're like old things. And crusty and behind, like they're being left behind in a lot of ways. And this has been a problem yeah. with science for a long time, because I think that institutionally science has tried to keep itself very separate. And now we're realizing mm-hmm. that look what happens to the government if and when you're not active, and if and when your voices yeah. aren't heard.
And the fact is that those who aren't, it's fine if you're not on social media, but for an entire field to not be fully represented on social media is dangerous, because people promoting pseudoscience, they're really good at social
media.
Oh,
yeah.
Look at all of these like juice cleanses being promoted and like weird vampire facials. And I don't even know what else because I don't follow.
Oh my gosh. I saw something about like baby foreskin facials recently. Like,
oh,
what
yeah,
is that?
Know.
Yeah. And it was like,
I don't know.
like legit celebrities were getting these done. It was like, okay.
And like, I don't mind, like, if you really are happy doing that, all the power to you. Like, I really live a you do you life, but I just want to give people the option to make informed decisions with their money, because it does matter. And so it's like, you can do what you want, but at least know that it may be a waste of money, but if it makes you happy, then it's not a waste. Cool. At least you're informed.
Yeah. But there are obviously, it's a whole other conversation that we could spend a whole other hour on. But like, there are people who are like, you know, grossly taken advantage of by.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's terrible.
Exactly.
And so it is good. Like, that's the thing. A lot of these things might seem disparate, and you might not have overtly mentioned that in this piece because you had limited, you know, word count. But like,
yeah,
this all speaks to an informed voting public, which is the most important thing civically that we need to focus on.
Yes, it's so important. And just that science is funded through public tax dollars for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
It's so elitist and rude to not give it back.
Yeah, oh, that's
and
such
to
a
not
good
share
point. Ugh.
To not share the return on investment. How are we going to expect people to keep like supporting science with their tax money if we don't tell them we don't give them the return on investment, which is knowledge? Like,
it's so true.
And I think the author recognizes that. I just think she was disenchanted by the fact that it's largely women and underrepresented minorities bearing the burden of sharing.
Yeah, obviously it was reactionary because she felt burdened. Like, seeing others thrive yeah. made her feel like, am I doing yeah. enough? And then when she said, am I doing enough? She felt indignant. Like, I don't feel like I should have to do that. You know, and it's totally fine to be a hardworking woman in science who doesn't also yeah. want to carry all of the wrongs of the past on your shoulders. Nobody's asking you to do that. But also it's really unfair to denigrate people who do want to work really hard to try and, you know, maybe not right the wrongs of the past, because I'm not sure if that'll ever happen, but at least start moving things in the right direction.
And I find it really motivating. Like, I'm like 6th year in my PhD. Stuff gets kind of boring, but then I share it online and people are so excited about it that it makes me fall back in love with my work, which is like really personally helpful.
Yeah.
And the fact that we can also make changes is great. And so I think the reason why women in marginalized groups like to do a lot of outreach is because we felt the negative impacts of that not happening. And so we want to do something to change it for the next generation. Like, I don't want a young woman who has certain interests to feel that she doesn't have a place in science, because I did feel that way.
Yeah.
So let me go out there and just be like, hey, girl, there's space for you.
I love that. You know that. Do you remember when the European Union put out this campaign a few years ago called like Science, It's a Girl Thing?
Yes.
And like it got all of this heat, which for very good reason it got heat.
Oh,
it was
God.
Really sexist.
It was the worst. Really
But I was asked about it publicly. I can't remember. I was on some sort of TV show and they were like, what do you think of it? And I was like, listen, like, it's totally gross. But at the same time, I'm not going to slam it as much as everybody else, because in a way, I think that it was motivated by an intention. Like, I can read between the lines of this, and there's something about it that speaks to me, which is, if you're a girl who doesn't look like a boy or act like a boy, which is fine, and you're a girl who actually likes to wear makeup and likes to wear, like, you know, Prada shoes to work, that's fine. And there's a place for you, because science isn't monolithic, and it's for all sorts of women. It's for all sorts of people. And it's just this, you know, I just got in a really big social media kind of argument with somebody, because I posted something about the gender gap. There's a new article that I probably won't close for 100 years. And there are all these, you know, the types of people who would call me a social justice warrior. There were all these people online who were basically saying, like, why do we need equity? And don't you think that the reason that there's, you know, no gender equity in science is because women have different interests? And let me show you all these charts that say that women have different interests. And I'm like, yeah, and how much of that is societally influenced? Whatever. So there's this long conversation.
Oh my gosh.
It was really frustrating. That was had about it. And it's, you know, I one of the points that I made was like, let's not forget that your great grandmother wouldn't have been allowed to get a PhD.
Yeah.
Like, that's just what we have to remember. Not that many generations ago, you couldn't even be in a department unless you were a secretary.
And so what shocks me is that women not that long ago got the right to vote.
Yes.
Right. And what you're saying. So it's almost, how could we expect there to not still be echoes of that in our society?
Of course.
Given the recency, of course, it's still reverberating through society. Like, and then now that's just an assumption. But then we look at the data and there are so many examples of how, and if we just address them, and that's not just doing equity for women, it's for everyone. It's for all marginalized groups, and people are marginalized in many different ways, men included. And we're fighting for all of that.
Yes. And then we see historically that there's within group problems when an entire movement is trying to achieve a goal, but they disagree about how to achieve it. And I think that that's like a really important point, is that it takes all types. I see it a lot within the atheist movement, which I'm, you know, kind of sort of in and sort of not in, is that there are people at the bleeding edge who are really firebrand, who are like out there rabble rousing. It's not really my way, but I'm glad that those people exist. Yeah. The same way that we probably never would have gotten the right to vote if it weren't for the suffragettes. And some of the suffragettes may have been violent even. They may have been sort of doing things that for a lot of people look like they were beyond the pale, but without those people who were the more kind of militant in their attempt, the people who didn't dedicate their lives to this movement, people like me who are like, I'd rather just go across my day and I just hope, you know, it's like I wouldn't be benefiting from their hard work.
And it goes actually right back to my research, how there are heterogeneous cells, there are heterogeneous people. And we need to stop having broad categories and just saying all feminists are the same, all atheists are the same.
Yeah.
And we need to instead be like, there are diverse opinions within that group. And we can't knock a whole group just because of like one incident. And this goes like also extends to stereotyping. Like, we need to just appreciate the heterogeneity in our world, both in our labs and in our social interactions. And when we do that, we realize that there is knowledge that's there in the differences that we need to appreciate and think about and investigate a little bit more.
Absolutely. I think that that's such a good closing point that you made. It brings everything back together. But Sam, I can't let you go yet. You want to know why?
Yeah. Why?
Because I close every episode asking my guests the same two questions, and I am fascinated to hear your answers to these two questions. So,
you
ready for that? Okay. All right.
Oh, yes.
I want you to think about the future, and I want you to think about it in whatever context is relevant to you right now. It could be the future of this very movement we've been talking about, the science communication community. It could be the future of women in science, or it could be bigger, you know, global movements, or even personal, like what are you going to do with your life, which we never really got into. Actually, I'm going to take a step back. You are, you know, probably a year-ish, give or take, plus or minus, away from having your PhD. Once you have that, you're at a crossroads, like every newly minted PhD is. Do you stay in the research world? Do you pursue SciComm as a full-time career? Do you do something completely different, like go into industry, but utilize all of your science and SciComm training and expertise? Do you know what you want to do yet?
So I'm one of those grad students who've changed like every year my opinion of what I want to do. For a while, I've been wanting to leave the research bench. Although more recently, I was falling more in love with research and thinking about maybe I want to stay. Then this whole thing happened and I'm like, no, I don't like academia. So, which is again, very ironic. So I want to pursue science communication full time. I want to continue doing research in science communication. I want to keep promoting citizen science and ways to do research and build knowledge outside of academia, which I think will be really fun. And I'm just really excited to be able to have more time and energy to devote to sharing science that I've been lucky to learn more broadly.
Oh, that's such a great goal. And you know what? It reminds me that using Talk Nerdy as a platform, I have this problem. Yeah. The same way that you were saying, like, I'm kind of self-conscious when I do selfies, I think about it and I don't want to show my body. I have this problem where I'm like, I don't like to self-promote. And I'm like, okay, I have an entire hour on this podcast every week. And then I'm like, I don't want to sell you anything. But I completely forgot that I co-run a science communication training camp every year along with my co-founder.
So
I wonder how many people listen to Talk Nerdy even know about this. But Jason Goldman, who's an incredible science writer, along with Sarah Curtis, who's also an incredible science writer, and myself, we founded, I think we're coming up on year five. We founded SciComm Camp several years ago in an effort to get a group of like-minded science communicators, whether it's people who are professional scientists or people who are professional science communicators and everything in between, who want to come together to learn from one another and also to learn from kind of industry giants and spend some time just kind of debriefing and hanging out in the woods, because we call it camp. It's a little confusing because it's not for kids, it's for grownups, but it's really fun. You get to stay in, it's like glamping, like they're cabins and they're really nice and you have your own bathroom. But the food's really good. It's in a beautiful part of LA that's surrounded by nature. And this year, it's going to be from November 2nd through 4th. So if anybody who's listening, who's like been so hanging on our every word during this chat, if this is for you, if SciComm is something you want to start or something you've been doing for a while, I highly recommend you come join us at this year's SciComm Camp. I think you'll love it. And you can learn more about it at SciCommCamp.com. That's easy to remember, right?
Yes. I've only heard the best things about it, and I will get there one day. Oh, I promise.
We definitely need to get you out here. All right. So Sam, now I'm going to ask you those two questions. And they are, when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you, number one, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night, you're most preoccupied with, you know, worried about? Like, what's the bummer thing that you're like, oh, not happy about this? And then number two, what are you actually really optimistic, excited about, and looking forward to?
I feel like my answers here won't be so surprising. So sorry for
that. That's okay.
The thing that bums me out the most is just misinformation and the way that we let misinformation proliferate and the way that we don't give people like access to data, I think. I just get so sad. Like, I've had people email me because I'm somewhat public telling me about these like fake stem cell clinics they're taking their kids to. And it just makes me, and they think that they're doing the best thing, but they're putting their kids at risk. And it's because people are taking advantage of them. And the thing that keeps me up at night is that, we harm people by keeping science away from them. And the people who like capitalize on that, selling fake supplements or whatever, like that just, I will stop that. Like that keeps me up.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. And
that is the fire
underneath. So is that really both? Is it the thing that bums you out, but also the thing you're excited for?
It is, because I'm like, there are so many cool ways to address that now, and I'm excited to do them, and I haven't done a lot of the things I want to yet. And I think there are other people who are getting mobilized to stop that. But yeah, misinformation, pseudoscience, and like inequitable access to information bums me out, but the way we're going to change it through innovative technologies gets me super stoked.
Absolutely. Oh, me too. You know, me too. And I'm so glad that we were able to take the time today to sort of peel back the curtain, because again, like on the show lately, I haven't really gotten into how the sausage is made too much. And I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll see based on feedback that I get from listeners, whether or not, you know, getting into the meat is something that they're interested in, or if it's something that like they are like, okay, you guys do you, but I just want to see the finished product. But, but the truth of the matter is I'm fascinated by it, and it's my show, so I can do what I want. So I have to say, thank you so, so much, Sam, for joining me. It's been a really, fascinating chat.
It's been so nice talking with you, and thanks to those who listened all the way till the end. I appreciate you so much.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. And as she said, listening all the way through to the end. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.